Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, New York Magazine published an article that quickly went viral. It's entitled, Experts Urge Clinton Campaign to Challenge Election Results in Three Swing States. One of the swing states mentioned is Michigan, and one of the computer scientists cited is J. Alex Halderman, the director of the University of Michigan Center for Computer Security and Society. The article says Halderman and some others believe there could be evidence that results in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania may have been, here's a quote, manipulated or hacked. Fred Woodhams from the Secretary of State's office is back with us. Fred, here we are 2 weeks after the election, talking to you again about election fraud. The New York Magazine article had some misinformation in it, according to U of M Professor Halderman. He issued a follow-up that was published on Medium.com, hoping to clear up some of the confusion. But what do you make of all of this?
Well, I am a little confused with it. I think the initial story in the magazine seemed to imply that there's different types of voting systems used in Michigan. There are not. We exclusively use optical scan paper ballot systems. So every voter in Michigan marked a paper ballot. That didn't come across very clearly, unfortunately, in some of the original coverage. And as I read through that Medium.com post from the professor, he, at least as how I read it, is that there were no allegations of hacking or fraud. He seems to just be raising concerns down the road. I think in the past he's advocated for certain policy changes nationwide and continues to do that. Certainly that's his right, but as far as we're concerned here in Michigan, there's no suggestion or allegation that there were any hacks or any attempts to that. And overall, we were very pleased with how Election Day went. It was very smooth overall across the state. And of course, we do have a very close election here for president here in the state of Michigan, but it doesn't affect whether or not Trump will be president or not. He has enough electoral college votes with or without Michigan.
One thing that Professor Halderman, who, by the way, declined an interview request, but put in his post, a hack is unlikely, but he does point to some vulnerabilities, including, he says, even if voting machines aren't connected to the internet, a poll worker could infect the precinct computers with malware directly. How possible does this seem to you?
We think that that is incredibly unlikely. It's important to keep in mind that there's about 9,000 voting jurisdictions across the United States. A full sixth of them, about 1,500, are here in Michigan. We have 4,800 precincts. So elections are run at the local level. They're run by the local clerk's office in people's city or township. So this is a very decentralized system that we have here in Michigan. We have about 30,000 election workers on Election Day. So it's not realistic in the real world. Some things to keep in mind is that all of the tabulators used on Election Day are tested extensively prior to Election Day to ensure that they're recording the votes cast correctly. Then the machines are secured by the local clerk's office. They do use memory cards. Those memory cards are sealed into the tabulators with a numbered seal. That seal is then recorded by the clerk's office to ensure that if there was any tampering, it would be readily apparent when you're going and looking at it and getting that tabulator moved to each precinct. So it's just simply not realistic.
Fred, if a campaign wanted a recount, what would that cost?
The cost to Clinton in particular would be $25 per precinct, so that's about $120,000 statewide. They don't have to request a full statewide recount. They could select individual precincts, so that cost would be less. Now, when people put a deposit for a recount down, if the result is changed, then that money is refunded to the candidate. Candidates have 2 days after final certification, and the Board of State Canvassers is scheduled to meet on Monday. So if one of the losing presidential candidates wished to seek a recount, they would have to do so by Wednesday.
By Wednesday. Just curious, as I'm thinking about that paper ballot I filled out, what happens to those ballots once the election is certified?
They are stored and maintained, and, here's something that people might be interested in. You can FOIA the ballot, so if people want to look over the ballots cast in Michigan, they have that avenue to do so. They don't need to seek a recount. It wouldn't have any repercussions, but if people think that, they just want to review the ballots themselves in certain precincts or what have you, they have that opportunity.
How long do you keep them?
I don't know that offhand, but they are kept for a significant amount of time after an election.
I'm sure it's a sizable storage area. Fred Woodhams, yeah, with the Michigan Secretary of State. Fred, thanks for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Donald Trump has chosen Amway heiress Betsy DeVos as his Secretary of Education. She's a staunch advocate for charter schools, for vouchers, and she's a leading GOP donor. We turn now to Ken Sikkema of Public Sector Consultants and, of course, former GOP State Senate Majority Leader. Ken, Betsy DeVos is Education Secretary. Were you surprised by this choice?
Not totally. It's certainly a bold choice. It indicates, I think, that President-elect Trump has a willingness to break the mold on conventional thinking when it comes to Education Secretary. Betsy has a very definite point of view on education in terms of charter and choice. But I think Trump shares that view. And so, no, I'm not totally surprised.
Now, looking at recent education secretaries, speaking of breaking the mold, we have had a former governor. We've had the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, a former college dean and school superintendent. We've had people with doctorates in education. What can you tell us about her credentials and her qualifications?
Well, she's been an activist in the field of education for many, many years. You know, I think it's probably a weakness in her resume that she doesn't have experience, you know, running a big district or, you know, professional experience per se in education. But once again, I see it as kind of a willingness on the part of Trump to kind of go beyond conventional thinking. I think that she has this view on charter and choice, but you know, she doesn't support choice for the sake of choice or vouchers for the sake of vouchers. It's kind of based on a belief that some established schools have become so stagnant over time that the only way you can provide an opportunity for every child is through choice and charters. And that's really what drives her. I've known Betsy for a long time. She was chairman of the Kent County Republican Party when I first ran for state representative 30 years ago. She was state party chair when I was in the legislature, I believe when I was in the state Senate. So I know that what really drives her views on education is this desire to have an opportunity for every child. It's not a ideological commitment to choice just for the sake of choice.
And based on those many, many years of knowing her, tell us a little more, Ken. What is she like?
Well, she's thoughtful. She's smart. She studies the issues. She is not a superficial person by any stretch of the imagination. She's going to approach the management of that department and education issues in a very thoughtful, careful, deep kind of manner and kind of way. So she's extremely educated and knowledgeable about these issues of education. I think it's a good choice, but it is a bold choice. It's not a conventional choice.
And of course, the National Education, the NEA, jumped right out with a statement basically saying, and I read a little bit of it, Betsy DeVos has consistently worked against their values of all students having a great public school in their community. So what kind of reception do you think she's going to get on Capitol Hill?
Well, Republicans control the House and the Senate, so she's going to get be welcomed with open arms because they share many of her views and many of her values. And her value is that every child. What drives Betsy? Because I've talked with her about this over many years, and not always agreed with her, but I have talked to her about this, and that is what drives her in the field of education. Is the desire that every child, no matter what circumstances they may be in, deserves a quality education. That's really what drives her. And she believes that opening up education to choice and opportunity and charters is how you achieve that.
Do public school proponents have reason to be afraid?
No, I don't think so at all. I think if you're a public school advocate, you know, you want every public school to be a quality school. And they're going to share that view with Betsy DeVos.
I guess we'll be seeing a lot of debate as this comes out and goes through. But as you say, with the Republican-controlled Senate, you can count that will go through. Although there is some complaining from conservatives about her ties to the political establishment.
Well, you're not going to ever find for any cabinet position or high-level government position, you're never going to have the sort of perfect choice that pleases everybody. The president's obligation, I think, to himself, really, is to pick somebody who shares his views and values and promote that person. And I think that's what Trump has done here. And that's Trump's obligation to himself.
Ken Sikkema, Public Sector Consultants. Thank you, Ken, for spending time with us on Stateside today.
Okay. Thanks, Cynthia.
We will analyze the DeVos appointment and what it means for education in Michigan and the country next week on Stateside. Up next.
You know, one woman talked about she had had a previous baby die right after birth, and she really felt like if she had not had Medicaid, like state health insurance, if she had had private insurance, that they would have treated her and her baby differently, and her baby might have lived.
A look at how we do maternity care in this country. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some 4 million women give birth in this nation every year. Yet American researchers have spent little effort exploring women's fear of childbirth. One exception is a recent University of Michigan study of fear during childbirth and just how that fear might affect outcomes for mother and baby. The study was conducted by my guest, Lisa Kane Lowe, an associate professor at the U of M School of Nursing, Women's Studies, and OBGYN. She's also president of the American College of Nurse Midwives, and Lee Roosevelt, a nurse midwife and clinical assistant professor at the Michigan School of Nursing. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Lisa, why did you decide that we needed to study on the fear of childbirth? I mean, what questions were you seeking to answer?
Well, when Lee and I were first talking about this as clinicians, you know, you see women and you're working with women regularly and seeing and observing some things that you're kind of trying to put together in your mind. And as clinicians, we knew that women really carried away some anxieties and fears as you'd talk to them in their prenatal visits. And so we started to think about how does this really impact the big picture of their experiences and their outcomes? Like if you put all the individual women's stories together that we were seeing, what is it that we can learn about and know about to be able to do a better job to reduce that fear?
And Lee, this study is one of only three of fear of childbirth in this country. And why do we know so little about something that so many people, so many women go through all the time? I guess I'm trying to get a sense why this research is so important.
And I think that's a good question. I don't really have an answer about why it hasn't been studied in the United States. There's quite a bit of extensive research that's looked at it in some of the Scandinavian countries. But when Lisa and I were sort of talking about the differences that when you have a country that has universal health care and a fairly homogenous population, really good, strong support systems, the fear of the childbirth experience looks very different than it does in the United States.
Beyond the pain part, what did you find that women are afraid of when it comes to pregnancy and giving birth?
Right. And I think when we think about fear of childbirth, we can think of it as also a very normative experience.
Yes.
That it's a new event. There's a lot of unknowns with it. And to have some fear and worry about it is very, very normal. What we see in clinical practice, though, is that for some women, that fear transcends that normal, see, and moves into a space where it interferes with the process of birth. And when the Scandinavian research really looked at fear of pain was a big one, fear of the mother dying or the child dying were sort of the three big fears that women in other countries had. And I expected to see those represented within women in the United States, too. And I think what was different, though, is that women in the United States talked about those things, but they talked about it like, yeah, of course, those are normal fears. Mm. But they had more sort of the fears that they wanted to talk about were more related to the structure of how healthcare is done. They had fears that their providers weren't going to pay attention to them and weren't going to listen to them or weren't going to be there, weren't going to treat them respectfully, that they were going to be giving birth in an institution. Either they were giving birth in a hospital and they didn't trust hospitals, or they were giving birth at home and felt a lot of fear about transferring to a hospital. But the fears that they talked about were more related to the maternity care system as a concept than the actual birth itself.
And then what did you learn as you talked with women and conducted this research, Lisa, as far as the result? How does it affect that fear, affect the outcome for mother and baby?
Well, what we know from larger studies is that fear, when it's an overriding fear like Lee described, greater than the normal, we start to see it impact the labor process. Women can't sort of let go and work within the process of normal labor, so they're more likely to have emergency cesareans. They're more likely to have some other complications during the labor process. They don't have risk factors that are medical risk factors. It seems to be related to this higher level of fear, which can disrupt your normal physiology. So those are the types of outcomes that can play out when you have this high level of fear. In the context of looking at the U.S. women, what we found is that the fears also resulted in some different behaviors. If you're very fearful of the healthcare system, your desire to access it is less, or when you do access it, you may not feel like you can trust. So you're not willing to necessarily say everything or talk freely and comfortably about all the issues that might be of concern to you. And you also may have a lot of self-doubt about whether you can even say that you're afraid and talk honestly about those things. So all of those relate to a provider not being able to necessarily understand where you're coming from and what might be needed to help you through the process or to assist you with the process. So those are some of the pieces. The other thing is, because we don't talk about it, it makes you also think, you know, there's the normal fears like Lee talked about, but it also makes you start to doubt yourself. And it starts to feel like something's wrong with you, when in reality, when we looked across the women in the study, what we found was that they were all having these types of fears, and that it was systematic in the healthcare. Their fears were systematic against the healthcare system and the way it's constructed, not that they had an individual disease or problem that they had to take individual responsibility for, that we needed to look broadly at our healthcare system and how we provide maternity care to think about how we might better be able to construct things.
Are we seeing the fears spread across the board, or are there some groups based on socioeconomic level or ethnic background or whatever factors you looked at that you tended to see women more fearful than in other groups?
I mean, I think particularly when we looked at women where English was their second language, and women of color, there's a long history of abuse by the healthcare system of these women. And that abuse and that history carries into their current experiences.
Distrust.
Right. So there was a lot of distrust of healthcare providers. And whether, you know, one woman talked about she had had a previous baby die right after birth, and she really felt like if she had not had Medicaid, like state health insurance, if she had had private insurance, that they would have treated her and her baby differently and her baby might have lived. And again, I don't know if that's the case or not.
But it felt real to her.
But it felt very real, and it's based on very real data that we have huge disparities in outcomes for women of color and their children. And women know that. And it plays into how they experience their pregnancy and how they experience interactions with their healthcare providers.
So it seems your study is focusing the spotlight on the state of maternity care in this country, and it, which leads to the question, what can maternity care providers do better than they have been doing, or not do that they have been doing, stop doing? What do you see?
Yeah, and I think that's very true, that when the more women I talk to about their experiences with fear of childbirth, the more we sort of realize that their fears were a very rational response to a pretty broken system. And like Lisa said, we're not sort of an individual psychopathology or something that needed therapy to treat. And I think what we as providers can do is work really hard to focus on that alliance between our patients and ourselves, that the prenatal care experience is not just going in and measuring the belly and listening to heart tones and answering a few quick questions and moving out of the room, that building of rapport and relationship with our patients is essential. And even if they aren't talking about their specific fears during those prenatal visits, if they feel more comfortable with their provider and that their provider is listening to everything that's going on in their life, that it can put women more at ease, mm-hmm. That they have a provider that is going to pay that amount of attention to them during the birth as well.
Well, I have to ask Lisa Kainlow, the medical system, take a typical office and there are so many patients that have to be gotten through. There's a lot of business mm-hmm. to medicine. Does that prevent a provider from spending that kind of time that is needed to kind of tease these things out?
Well, yes, I think that there's definitely challenges in how we relate to each other when we're pushing through a number of people in a short amount of time. That said, there are some new models of prenatal care that are out there that have been shown to be very effective, particularly in groups where they have been receiving poor care or have had poor health outcomes. So what that model of care is group prenatal care. And, you know, I think one of the things that Lee was alluding to is that instead of it being the provider's agenda for what we do during those visits, and there is the need for certain measurements mm-hmm. and assessments, that's why you're going to your healthcare provider. But at the same time, that agenda is just a piece of who we are. Biologically, you know, our biology is only a piece of it, but it's the whole way in which we're living that also informs the healthcare provider and what's happening in that person's life and how they might be able to talk to them about opportunities for health and well-being, resources and support. And so we have to not make it our agenda when we go into the prenatal visit. We have to look at what's the woman's agenda or the family's agenda as they're coming into the office. What do they need? What are their priorities? And instead of telling them information, actually asking and listening to what their goals are. So you hear a lot about, you know, shared decision making and patient engagement are two terms that are really getting a lot of interest today in looking at healthcare in general, but in maternity care in particular, I think it's a salient need to pay attention to.
Right. Finally, I have to ask you, Lee, speaking of women together, let's talk about the sisterhood. What do you think women can do or stop doing as they talk to friends or family members, to expectant moms about childbirth? I guess I'm asking, should we be laying off the war stories? Because you do see that happen where you're like, oh, you won't believe how long I was in labor or whatever. Fill in the blank.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing about birth is that, you know, for eons, it has been a rite of passage for women. And I think the way that we talk about rite of passages is often in the sort of warlike language. So I think in some ways that's not entirely problematic. I think what we can do for other women is instead of relaying all of our experiences, asking, how are you doing? Like, what are you thinking about this birth coming up or new parenthood? Or, you know, I always sort of think of the example, one of the first, I think it was my first trip out with my daughter right after she was born, and she was like 10 days old, and I was at Kroger and I was uncomfortable and exhausted. And this woman came up to me and said, enjoy it. This is the best it's ever going to be. And I thought, if that's the case, like, I am in serious trouble here.
Because I'm not enjoying this very much.
Yeah. And how much that said. And then, so like, I've made it my mission to go up to new moms and say, this part's so hard, it gets better. Mm. And I think any ways that we can sort of connect with women around not just our own experiences, but their experiences leads to a culture of support and leads to a change in the culture of how we talk about pregnancy and birth and new parenting.
Interesting research. Lisa Kainlow and Lee Roosevelt, nurse midwives with the University of Michigan School of Nursing, on their study. And I'm sure you've just begun to scratch the surface, and there's much more study to be done and mm-hmm. questions to be answered. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who was James Jesse Strang, and what led Strang to proclaim himself King of Beaver Island. Don Faber explores those questions in his latest book, James Jesse Strang, The Rise and Fall of Michigan's Mormon King. Writer Joan Donaldson has this review.
On July 8, 1850, with a crimson robe and a paper crown, James Jesse Strang was crowned King of Beaver Island. His coronation completed his youthful ambition to enter into royalty, but it would also result in his assassination. In Don Faber's well-researched book, James Jesse Strang, The Rise and Fall of Michigan's Mormon King, the author declared that he wanted to present the historical Strang, stripped of myth, demonization, and popular fancy. Michigan history aficionados and folks who love Beaver Island will appreciate how Faber reveals Strang as a complex character, whom some view as a prophet and others as a charlatan. One of the biography's greatest strengths is that Faber explains the cultural background of the early 1800s and how it influenced Strang. During this period of political and social change, Strang experienced the energy of the Protestant camp meetings and read about the utopian communities such as New Harmony, Indiana, and the Shaker villages dotting the East Coast. Eventually, the young lawyer from New York embraced the Mormon faith that had a beguiling simplicity. Through the narrative, Faber continues to refer back to the character of the time period as he develops Strang's story. For those readers who are not familiar with basic Mormon history, Faber included information about Joseph Smith and the early struggles of the Mormon Church. He explains how Strang's penchant for glory propelled him to attempt to trump Smith's achievements. Like Smith, Strang said he had discovered brass plates that only he could translate. From the plates, he wrote the Book of the Law of the Lord, hoping that his volume would usurp the exalted position of the Book of Mormon. After divine revelation, Strang also embraced polygamy, adding four plural wives to his household. And yet today, Joseph Smith remains a revered Mormon prophet, while Strang's name is mostly remembered in Michigan. In another outstanding chapter, Faber shows Strang's power in the state legislature. When Strang arrived in the state capitol, the other representatives thought he would be a religious fanatic who preached about his cult. Instead, the King of Beaver Island proved to have a sense of vision. He wrote a proposal for a system of locks at Sault Ste. Marie, and he encouraged the state to link the two peninsulas with a bridge. But the cunning Strang also introduced legislation that gerrymandered northern Michigan in a way that allowed the Mormons to gain elected positions and more power. His political maneuvering enraged the Gentiles with whom Strang had battled for years, especially the residents of Mackinac Island. Eventually, in 1851, the state of Michigan would try Strang for treason and acquit him. By showing the anger simmering on Mackinac Island, Faber foreshadows the demise of the king. Even for those who have read other books about the Mormon king, they will want to read this book's chapter devoted to Strang's diary, where Faber finds answers to the questions, what characteristics and desires created such a dictator? What about the man attracted his followers? Strang penned his diaries between the ages of 18 and 23, and sections were written in code so his thoughts could not be used against him. By dissecting the diary and drawing from the analysis of other historians, Faber explains the inner workings of Strang's mind. Not only did Strang lust for power, but in Faber's words, fame was the end to which he shaped his life. It is the means by which he achieved his fame that makes his story compelling.
Joan Donaldson writes from her organic blueberry farm near Saugatuck. Her novel, On Viney's Mountain, won the 2010 Friends of American Writers Award, and it represented the state of Tennessee at the 2010 National Book Festival. Her essay is part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can hear her review and others at MichiganRadio.org. Still to come, a recipe for a conflict-free Thanksgiving. We'll talk about conflict resolution as we head into the holiday after such a bitterly divisive election. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Epiphanies.
Heart of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
Abandoned houses, one of the greatest challenges to reviving Detroit's neighborhoods. But what happens if you take a burned out, abandoned eyesore of a house and repurpose it into a passive geothermal greenhouse, an urban agriculture project that doesn't take up a lot of space and finds new uses for the derelict houses that scour the city? That's what our latest contributor to The Next Idea is exploring. Stephen Mankusch is an associate professor of architecture at the University of Michigan and here with us now to tell us about the Afterhouse project. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
What is Afterhouse?
Well, Afterhouse is a project that my partner Abigail Murray came up with a few years ago, which reuses the foundations of a house to construct a passive solar greenhouse, a sunken greenhouse in the ground.
And what does it mean, this idea of a semi-subterranean passive geothermal greenhouse? It sounds
very
fancy.
So complicated, right?
What is it?
Well, it's actually a concept that has been with us since antiquity, which is basically using the earth as a heat battery so that in the summer when the temperatures are really hot in greenhouses, the earth helps moderate that high temperature. And in the winter, it keeps the warmth, uses the warmth of the earth to heat the structure. But what it really means is not growing a hot house where we grow tomatoes, but growing crops that grow south of here, mostly Mediterranean-type crops like figs or pistachios, pomegranates, crops that require actually a freeze in their germination cycle to produce fruit.
So give us an idea. If I walked in on a 20-degree day in January, what would the climate be like?
It'd probably be quite warm. 20 degrees is not that cold, depending, of course, on what the weather is like outside, whether it's sunny or not. If it was sunny, it would actually be quite warm there. It might be even, I would expect it to be in the 40s to 50 degrees easily. If it was overcast, though, it would probably still be above freezing temperatures, which is still quite balmy, I guess, for 20-degree weather, right?
Using absolutely right. No energy to make
right,
that happen.
Right, absolutely no energy.
And, totally.
And the idea was really, it's a house that's made to comfort plants, not human beings. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing to remind ourselves, that that we're really building this for the plants and not for us.
So tell us about the house you've chosen for this project, because it's basically kind of a demonstration project that you're doing right now near Hamtramck.
Yeah, it took us a while. Abigail and I wanted to make sure that we would find the right neighborhood to do the project, and we wanted somewhere that was an active neighborhood that wasn't on the fringe where there wasn't much happening. So, and we wanted to find the ideal partner where the greenhouse would be taken care of over time. Through a friend, we met a man called Andy Malone, who's an artist that lives in this neighborhood north of Hamtramck. And he purchased the house because it was an eyesore, and it was one of the houses that started turning that street, which is a dead-end street called Burnside. And so when we met him, it became a perfect match. Also because the neighboring house to Afterhouse is owned by Kate Dodrill, who is a community gardener. So we said, okay, this is a perfect match for the project.
How long has it taken? So you're stripping it down
mm-hmm.
and doing what with that site? Are you using any part of what had been the house in this besides the foundation?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So the process means taking down the house by hand rather than using a large construction crane. And we recovered all the construction lumber, the structural lumber from the house, which we then repurposed to build a new greenhouse. We also used materials to imprint. This was an idea that Abigail really wanted to do, was to imprint the wood grain of the existing structure onto a new concrete beam that surrounds the foundation that holds the house together after the house was demolished.
Tell us what it'll look like once it's all done. Describe it. Will there be a roof?
The house looks a little bit like the house that was there before because it has the same footprint. But the main difference, and it has a pitched roof, but the main difference is that instead of the roof pitching towards the street, which normally houses do, it actually pitches towards the sun. So it creates actually an interesting prismatic look. It looks, at one level, it looks very contemporary. At another level, it looks very ordinary. And the roof is made of polycarbonate, which is a greenhouse material. And so when you go to the structure and you get close to it, you'll be able to look down into the green that you'd normally expect. We're also building a garden in front of it to preserve the same interface that porches normally have with the house. So most of the houses there have this porch condition. So it has a lot of the elements of the house that was there before, but it's a little bit different. And the other one thing that is interesting is We reused a lot of scrap wood from a lumber mill called Hardwoods of Michigan. And they have all these strips of wood that are normally end up waste because of the ends of boards that get milled down. So we wanted to clad the house in wood, but at the same time we were worried that with time it would weather and it might look blighted because it starts graying out. So we researched this technique, in part because Abigail works with burnt wood in her ceramic work. We decided to use the technique called shoju sugiban, which is the burning of wood to preserve it. So the outside of the house on three sides is all made out of this stripped black burnt wood, which at one level looks really austere, being a house that burned down on Burnside Street. But it was through a community meeting that everybody in the neighborhood really loved the idea because it looked finished. It was a black, just beautiful sheen on the house. It was both at one level poetic, but another level very functional as well.
And what has the neighborhood felt about having this construction in its midst?
It's been quite exciting for a number of reasons. One, while there is a lot of sort of repair construction that occurs in the neighborhood, people are fixing up their houses, this is the first project that really raises a house to the ground and builds it anew. So that generates just a lot of excitement to see something coming up, brand new construction being built in the neighborhood. I think also the quality, being an architect myself and an artist, we're very much concerned with bringing a level of finish that is normally not present in that type of neighborhood. It's more present in a wealthier district where people pay a lot of attention to craft. So that's another thing that we felt was important to bring to the neighborhood.
What do you hope could come from what you're learning in After House? How do you see this spreading beyond Burnside Street?
So there are multiple things, and there are multiple ways of spreading what we do. There is the obvious sort of idea of the house itself, but the concept of not necessarily demolishing things immediately, the idea of possibly retaining at least the foundations of homes for other future uses, be it even just a root cellar, maybe a very low-tech, small greenhouse that would only, let's say, you could grow flowers in, like for Flower House that we spoke of earlier, or just even used as a porch, an outdoor porch for a neighboring house. I think the advantage of that is it buys time for the neighborhood to recover so that if there is a future where there is more need for houses, that house could be converted into residence, or it could be converted into something else as well when there's a bit more money to convert it.
And compare the cost of what you're doing to transform this burned out house into this greenhouse versus coming in and ripping it down.
You know, the demolition of a house can vary on its size between $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, depending how big it is in a traditional sense. And what happens is they remove the entire foundation out of the structure, out of the ground, and then they have to refill the area up with clean earth, which also basically means taking out all the infrastructure that was built in there. So there's a cost to that, but the demolition and leaving the structure intact, doing it by hand can be expensive because it takes more time. However, a lot of the infrastructure that was put in there and just the natural resources that were put into the concrete of the foundation, et cetera, and all that sort of labor that was invested in that ground years and years ago is not just thrown out the door. What can happen is right now the major demolition companies are not operating to remove, let's say, the top of a house. What they do is they use the existing foundation as a receptacle for demolition, like a large trash can, and then they remove everything from there. So it does require, to make it less expensive, a way of deconstructing that is thought out, that is engineered. And in that sense, it could become even cheaper. It's hard for me to say, oh, it's cheaper to save a foundation than it is to demolish it because you have to invest in repairing it. But I feel that it's probably like a break-even situation in the end. But it offers more possibilities for futures that don't exist with the removal, which is also the ratio of history, not just, you know, memories and all the things that are in the neighborhood of a place. So that's a cost that's hard to obviously
no price tag on that.
Right. Yeah.
You've actually had neighbors come and want to help.
Yeah, that was the other thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of what does After House do, what can it do for other places, is that it's generated a lot of skills in the neighborhood. People learned a lot building on the project because we hired the neighbors from across the street. We worked with the mason that lived down the road. And they've been introduced to a different type of construction, one that is not sort of typically understood as sort of mass track housing or your typical labor, but a much more sort of careful attempt at preservation than you would sort of expect normally. The other thing that it does is that in terms of the neighborhood, there's a lot of young kids that live in the neighborhood. And in the evening, especially in the summer, you just kind of hear all these kids in the neighborhood playing and they come around and people in the evening stroll and they come and check the progress on the house. And it's just like a lovely moment to sort of share something that you're doing with the people that live there, because they're just so curious to know what's happening. To even the idea that you could grow plants in a house that was burned down for them is a novelty.
Well, you definitely have to go to the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org and check out the photographs that Stephen has brought us to give us an idea of what was there and what will be there. How close are you to being done?
We're very close. We put in the stairs into the structure. So what happens, of course, with an after house is you go down into it. You don't step up or step straight into it. So that's what we are building right now. The group of volunteers on Sundays. We did receive a lot of help from University of Michigan, from the Kresge Foundation, to get this project off the ground. And we did pay for the majority of the labor involved in the house. But at this point, we're kind of finishing off with mostly volunteer work, which helps spread the knowledge and just brings a lot of people that want to contribute to the project.
And when do you think you'll be able to grow crops?
We're hoping by November we can plant some crops. They might not grow much because it's going to be, you know, there's not going to be much sunlight. But we're hoping that some things will last the winter, which they normally don't, like rosemary plants and other bushes that normally can't survive winters here.
Well, a very creative way of looking at one of the biggest problems that the city faces with abandoned houses. Stephen Mankusch, Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of Michigan. We want to thank you for being with us on The Next Idea. And again, go to michiganradio.org and click on The Next Idea, and you'll see some of the photographs of After House. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to our series, Minding Michigan, as we focus on mental health and wellness. The holidays can be a happy time, but putting family members around the Thanksgiving table can also resurrect tensions and old resentments. And this year, we're struggling with the aftermath of the election. Some people are jubilant, some are fearful and angry. So it is pretty easy to envision people eyeing each other suspiciously across the Thanksgiving dinner table. Let's get some ideas for turning down the conflict as we say hello now to Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farhah Abbasi. It's good to have you back, Dr. Abbasi.
It's good to be back, Cynthia. Thank you.
Dr. Abbasi, when we think about the way people feel at Thanksgiving, it is about coming together. It was the roots of the whole holiday, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So this was initially, this tradition was brought by an immigrant group which was fleeing religious persecution. These were pilgrims and Puritans coming from England. And this was a very religious celebration where they would celebrate harvest, and there was days of harvesting that was celebrated. But the tradition was that the host and the immigrants, they all came together and break bread.
And together. So here we are in these turbulent and divisive days after this election. Let's say somebody voted one way in the election and knows his entire family voted the other way. And he's really torn because he feels so deeply about the election, about how it turned out, and suddenly looking at family members with new eyes and doesn't feel good. So how do you approach the holiday that is supposed to be about giving thanks when you're in that frame of mind?
We definitely are all recovering from the jarring and toxic demagoguery of the recent election. I do see friendships have been broken, relationships have been strained, and people are struggling to sit across tables with friends and family who voted differently. I personally feel it almost feels like we have reaped this harvest of hate and we are in winter of our discontent. First of all, as a mental health provider, I want to talk more about what conflict is. Conflict is always deeper than just a mere disagreement. It is very deep-seated. Parties feel or perceive a threat to their well-being and survival. And people tend to feel guarded, react emotionally, and these end up intensifying arguments and invariably hurting each other more. So given Thanksgiving is seeped into the tradition of sharing and love and harmony. But I always feel that even a meal prepared with a lot of love and care can taste like sawdust if the ambience surrounding it is acrylic and angry.
Dr. Abbasi, would you spell out your recipe for a conflict-free Thanksgiving?
Here's my recipe for a conflict-free Thanksgiving, Cynthia. So first of all, I do feel that it's very important to practice mindfulness these days. And mindfulness literally means being in the moment, focusing on the moment. And remember, everyone is there to share a meal and celebrate. And to me, arguments are like salt. Little bit of salt is always very tasty, which is like having a healthy debate. But excessive and uncontrolled amount makes you more sick than feel better.
Certainly.
Acknowledging one's emotion is important, but knee-jerk responses are like sugar and carbs. They feel sweet for a moment, but overindulgence can leave one with a lot of guilt and regret. So I feel turkey and laughter both are good mood foods. You know, most of our serotonin receptors are in our stomach. So when you eat turkey, you feel good and it increases serotonin. And having laughter cuts the tension. So have a lot of laughter while you are carving that turkey.
Let's hope that people will do that. That's kind of where we're at, is we hope people will be open to doing that.
Absolutely. And on top of that, I feel smiles are contagious. They are like these baked croissants, warm out of the oven. They can warm your tummy. They can warm your soul. So smiles should be shared generously. And on top, sprinkle some gratitude on every hot cup of coffee you are going to drink this Thanksgiving. And share this joy by volunteering in your community. And in the end, I would say the cherry on Thanksgiving pie has to be honoring our indigenous communities and by donating to relevant and worthy causes.
That's a good recipe. Now, here's the question. What are the best steps to take if we're at the table and tensions rise and an argument arises? You know, somebody just can't resist the moment.
I would say that you need to focus on the words, not the person. Make it about the discussion, not about the person. Don't start attacking the person. And then if you feel that the things are getting out of hand, you need to step away from it and at least try and listen actively to what the other person is trying to bring. Because I feel most of the time these arguments become heated because the other party is feeling completely invalidated or is feeling that their needs are not being met.
I would suspect a good place to start might be for the host to kindly say, let's keep this dinner a politics-free zone.
I wish we could go to that, but to some people, this has become such an important election. It has become about who they are going to be and how they are going to proceed. But another thing is we can turn this into a moment for growth, a moment for possibilities. So we can really turn every problem into a possibility and try and work through this.
Dr. Farah Abbasi, we want to thank you very much. Appreciate your Thanksgiving tips and your recipe for a conflict-free Thanksgiving. And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Same to you, Cynthia, and to your listeners. I hope we all have a wonderful, soul-filling and stomach-filling Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, hoping you and yours have a very, very happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening.